back to the LSE. It's already, I know, a little way through the term, but I'd like to say I hope that everyone here has a wonderful term at the LSE. Do keep your eyes open for the LSE events leaflet, because we've got a lot of interesting speakers coming this term and next term from the outside world. So please do keep your eyes open, because there are so many interesting people coming to the LSE, but it's often hard to pick up the information. So I think you've got to be fairly proactive about that, really. Well, here we are in the new millennium. Well, if we are in the new millennium, I'm just talking to other people in the audience there, and time is a socially constructed thing, and we, you know, it's a sort of Western-style millennium. I'd like to just say that in this millennium, I'll be giving two lectures, this one today and one further one next week. The one next week is going to be about the theme, is globalization a Western project? What should we do about global inequalities? How do we handle the shape of the world that was sort of graphically displayed at the Seattle confrontations? What kind of world is this shaping up for us? Today I'd like to consult you a bit about this, actually. I mean, here we all are, in some sense anyway, give or take different cultures in a new century, let's say century rather than millennium. A lot of you are going to live a lot longer than I am into this century. Be quite interested to find out what your views are about it. I mean, if I ask the audience here, how many people in a general way feel optimistic about what the century has to offer in terms of economic development and prosperity? How many people would say they're optimistic about the next 100 years or so? How many people feel the reverse, pessimistic about it? Well, in the last lecture, we might perhaps have a brief discussion of the reasons for this. I mean, on the whole, that seems a balance towards optimism. I mean, that would be the view that I have, cautious optimism, really, about the possibilities facing humanity at this kind of transition. If I were to ask you, do you think that there is likely to be a world war during this century of the kind that happened in the last century? How many people here would think that there won't be any more world wars during this century? Optimists would have to put up their hands, I believe. Should mainly be the same people. How many people think that there will be, that being falsely optimistic, that there might be global wars? Not that many. Quite interesting, because forgive me if I quoted this statistic at you before, but there was a study done in the year 1997 that showed there are a lot of wars going on in the world in 1997, but only one involving nations. But I did mention at the end of the last lectures, I think that was Pakistan shaping up to India. So it does seem to be some kind of transition in the nature of war happening. How many people think that unending economic prosperity is possible? Because there must be some economists in this audience and others who take an interest in economic issues. You know, there's a big discussion going on at the moment about whether the American economy, which is the driver of the world economy, can sustain indefinite prosperity. Some people think it's possible for a longish period. Others think the American economy is a bit like the Asian economies were a few years ago. It's essentially a bubble economy based upon inflated share prices and inflated property prices. And in the next couple of years or so, there's going to be a dramatic reversal in the fortune of the American economy and therefore the world economy. Who thinks that the American economy and therefore the world economy could have a period of stable economic growth for the next, say, 5 years? Who would think that's possible? Quite a lot of optimists also in that group, I noticed. Who would think that the US economy is a bubble economy and that a kind of 1929 situation could happen? So on balance, there's this optimistic generation sitting here, or optimistic group, since it covers various generations, I suppose. With that, certainly on the whole, would be my view. I was listening to a program on Radio 4 just about New Year's time, and people were talking about What was the most important invention or innovation of the 20th century? Anyone got any candidates for that? Well, for what it's worth, one woman on the program suggested the portable hairdryer, which I thought was interesting little suggestion. But what I was going to start the lecture by proposing to you was that perhaps you could make a case for democracy as the most significant innovation affecting not just Western societies but other societies in the 20th century. And democracy, its expansion, what it's all about, why it seems to be spreading across the world, that is the topic of this lecture today. Democracy, you can say, unlike hairdryers probably, has a long history and a short history. The long history of democracy, of course, goes back to classical times. The idea of democracy, you could say, in a certain sense, is not really new at all. Because 2,000 years ago, Greece, to some extent the Roman Republic, were already democracies. Interestingly, you find in lots of traditional cultures a kind of intuitive notion of democracy, which is where local communities are ruled by councils of elders, and those councils of elders in small traditional cultures are sometimes sort of to some extent elected by acclaim by the local community group. So the idea of democracy is not just limited to the classical world. A certain sense in which it's been around for a long time in a lot of different cultures. However, I think you have to say the long history of democracy is very different from its short history, because democracy in the classical world and democracy in traditional cultures was always very limited. Where that notion appeared, it was limited normally to an elite, the kind of propertied elite that you had in the classical world, for example, or the elite of elders that used to have in traditional communities. It was always limited to men, of course. Women were never formed part of the democratic community such as it was in traditional cultures. So you have to say the short history of democracy, which is the connection between democracy and the rise of modern industrial society, the short history of democracy is actually quite different from the long one. It's not just a continuation of it. The idea of mass democracy, the idea that everybody, women as well as men, people without property as well as people with property, should have the right to participate in the democratic process. This was essentially an idea introduced by the American and French revolutions. It was the kind of guiding idea, really, of those two great revolutions that instituted modern democratic politics. So the idea of democracy, the form of democracy, that is closely associated with modernity, the rise of modernity, and therefore again, of course, with the rise of the West. And as we'll be discussing in the next lecture, you have to ask whether democracy itself is in some sense a Western phenomenon or a Western sort of ideal, which might not be generalizable across the world. There is therefore a break in history with the invention of modern mass democracy, but we seem to be seeing another break today, because the idea of democracy really was repopularized in the 19th century. You had the emergence of democratic states, but really you can say it's only in the 20th century that as an idea, democracy has become more or less universal, and as a practice, it's become radically extended. The 20th century, if it's been the century of World War, has also been the century of the ascent of democracy. The idea of democracy, the notion, you know, the concept of democracy, has become universal, really, during the course of the 20th century. It's important to recognize that in the early history of democracy, most people, especially elites, resisted it. Democracy was never a popular idea, especially among ruling groups, until well into the 20th century. Now you'd be very hard put to it to find any ruling group which does not declare itself democratic, or at least committed to the principles of democracy. You might make an exception for countries like Saudi Arabia, where you still have a quasi-feudal monarchy, But even there, the idea of democracy is certainly alive and well discussed. The Soviet Union called itself a people's democracy. China calls itself a people's democracy. One of the guiding ideas of Marx was the idea of radicalizing democracy. So the notion of democracy has become more or less universal in the history of the 20th century. It moved from being quite a marginal idea in the early part of the century, restricted to few groups, few countries. Women didn't have the right to vote in most countries until well into the 20th century. The idea of democracy has now become more or less universal. You could say it sort of conquered the world along with the economic developments and other aspects of Western industrialism which have spread so rapidly during the course of the 20th century. So I reckon it's a better candidate than the hairdryer, interesting though that innovation might be. Now the idea of democracy, of course, is distant from its reality. And what we're seeing at the end of the century, the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the new century, is, I think, a real generalization of the structural form of democracy. Not just the idea of democracy becoming universal, but a widespread expansion of those countries in the world that could legitimately be called democratic. Now, how would one define democracy? Well, that's a pretty contentious matter, as you, I'm sure you know, but I'll just opt for a minimalist definition of it. I say democracy exists where you have a multiple party system, political parties competing with one another, where you have free and non-corrupt voting procedures to elect political leaders, and where you have an effective legal framework of civil liberties, or if you like, human rights, which underlie the mechanics of voting processes. You could define democracy in a much more elaborate way. But defined in that way, in this minimalist way, I think you can make the claim that over the past 30 or so years, and remember, if you can cast your mind back to the last millennium, that remember that I've been concentrating on the past 30 or so years in this series of lectures, because I'm arguing there are very profound changes going on in world society over that period. Over the past 30 or so years, about three times as many countries in the world can be said to possess effective democratic institutions as measured by these criteria than was the case in the 1960s. It is demonstrable, I think, and there have been quite a number of empirical studies in political science comparing different countries across the world over that period. It is demonstrable that democracy is much more widespread today than it was 30 or so years ago. In other words, through the 20th century, you don't just have a gradual expansion of democracy. Something's happened over the past 30 or so years which seems to be radically pushing forward the democratization of political systems across the world. I think this is demonstrable in spite of the fact that there are obvious and very, very large exceptions to it. In countries which are trying to make a transition to democracy, defined in this way, such as Russia, for instance, you have very problematic partial process of democratization. In China, you have the Communist Party, which still, by and large, calls itself a people's democracy, is not a democratic system as measured by these criteria. You have a whole range of countries in Africa where you still have widespread corruption, patronage, force voting figures, which couldn't by any real reckoning be called effective democracies. In addition to that, you have the possibility that you could go backwards. You could say that although there are more democracies in the world than there used to be, maybe in 20 or so years ago, it's 20 or so years' time, many of these might have relapsed into authoritarian regimes. Because if you look at Latin America, for example, countries there, quite a few countries, major countries in Latin America, have been democracies in the past, then have experienced forms of authoritarian or military government, and now have become democratized again. Well, someone could say, well, perhaps this will all relapse and you might have a reversion to authoritarianism or military rule. I want to suggest to you in this lecture that this is unlikely, at least as a general phenomenon, and that there are powerful reasons for supposing that democracy has not only become more widely established, but will become more, even more widely established over the next 30 or so years than it was over the last 30 or so years. One good reason to be cautiously optimistic about what the world holds for the future. Now, I think most political scientists do accept that there are far more effective democracies in the world today than there were 30 or so years ago, and the question is how you explain that phenomenon. Now, one type of explanation is what you could call a kind of catching up explanation, very popular among some on the political right, I think. The catching up type explanation argues that if you look, for example, at the transitions in Eastern Europe in 1989 from communism to emerging democratic states with capitalist economies, you look at that transition, what's happening, so the catching up theory says, is that people have found out that communism doesn't work. They found out that a command economy doesn't work, and they're therefore catching up with the forms of liberal democracy, parliamentary democracy, and a capitalistic market system which the Western countries have had for a long time. So you can explain democratization as a kind of process of historical experimentation. People have been experimenting with other systems, fascism, communism. They found these haven't worked, and therefore they've turned to democracy plus capitalism as an answer, and they're kind of falling into line with what the Western countries have been like. Now, I think there are strong reasons to doubt this explanation, and I would propose quite a different one. Some of the reasons why one might doubt this explanation, and why one might say there's something rather special going on in the world today, are the following, I think. First of all, the process of democratization is affecting all continents in the world. You only have to look, as I said, to Latin America, but also to different countries in Africa, like Mali or Mozambique, for example, or to Asia, look what's seemingly happening in Korea, Taiwan, and other places. Look to the persistence, of course, of democracy in India. Look to the introduction of democracy in Eastern Europe to see that there is a generic process involved. It can't, I think, just be that people at a certain stage of history suddenly woke up to the problems of alternative regimes. There's something very general going on affecting all of us in the world which must have a general explanation. Second, if you look at the 1989 events in Eastern Europe, there's good reason to suppose that these are quite different from previous forms of revolutionary transition. If anyone's interested in that topic academically, I'd quite strongly recommend the writings of Zygmunt Bauman, the sociologist from University of Leeds, on these issues. Bauman points out that the 1989 revolutions were quite different from the past because they didn't involve violence. They involved a rapid process of movement from one country to another. These things started in Poland, moved to Hungary, moved to East Germany, and so forth. There were lots of people in the streets, but the elite kind of faded away without much active confrontation. Only in Romania, one or two other isolated examples, was there a kind of confrontation of a prolonged kind between the state authorities and the social movements involved. And in Russia itself, you had a transition, really, even though it might be only a partial transition, without a great deal of violence involved. Bauman calls these the first postmodern revolutions. Postmodern revolutions, he says, because you can see in them the impact of television, the impact of media, the fact that people are responding to new forces outside of the countries themselves to much more general forces. And the fact there was no violence, that they weren't like classical revolutions, shows that we're dealing with something different here from political transitions in the past. There's a third reason, I think, to indicate that we're dealing with something fairly unusual. In other words, something which is structurally to be looked at in terms of the changes I've mentioned in earlier lectures. And this is the disaffection with democracy in the established democratic states. This is an interesting little paradox, that if you're going to explain the expansion of democracy, you must also explain, I think, at the same time as democracy is spreading around the world, in those countries which you could define as the core countries of democracy, the liberal democratic states of Western Europe, the United States, Australasia, and so forth, there is increasing disaffection with democratic institutions. This has been, again, exhaustively looked at by political scientists, and I'd recommend the work of the Harvard political scientist Joe Nye. One of his books is called Trust in Politics, who did a lot of survey work in the United States and Western European countries, investigating people's levels of trust in orthodox democratic systems and in politicians. And almost all countries you find declining levels of trust in political leaders. You also, quite interestingly, find declining levels of trust in authority figures in general, whether these be professors or doctors or professionals, for example. You find in many countries lower levels of voting turnout than in the past, especially in the United States. You find a higher degree of expressed disaffection, especially among the younger generation, with existing democratic procedures and structures. I think to explain this, you have to look to the same phenomena, strangely enough, which explain the very expansion of democracy itself, and I'll come back to that in a minute. I want to propose to you, therefore, anyway, that in order to explain the expansion of democracy to begin with, you have to look to the structural forces that we've been analyzing, I've been trying to analyze in these lectures. First, the impact of the very theme of the lectures themselves, the impact of globalization. Globalization, as I tried to suggest to you, shouldn't be understood primarily as the expansion of only the global marketplace. It's driven by the communications revolution. It's driven by especially the expansion of technology of satellite communications and the interaction of satellite communications with information technology. Creating in a world really where nothing can be hidden. In an increasingly globalized world, it doesn't even matter if you're poor or you're rich, you have access to a range of informational sources, which mean that things are much more visible than they used to be. You can trace this out in a recent issue of great interest that I alluded to briefly in the last lectures in respect of corporate power in the recent history of Monsanto, the corporation that tried to purvey genetically modified foods across the world. Monsanto, only about 2 years ago, seemed to be a world leader in promoting genetically modified foods, very strong market position. But then, of course, you've got all sorts of protests occurring all around the world. Monsanto had no way of confining its experimentation to one part of the world. It was faced by a kind of revolt across the world, a kind of consumer ecological revolt. As a result, the value of the shares in Monsanto has dropped very radically, and the company has recently had to restructure itself and seek to merge with another corporation. What applies to corporations applies to governments, I think. There is no longer anywhere to hide. Although if you're in an authoritarian regime, of course you try and control information. And of course you can do it to some degree. But it's much, much harder than it ever was 20 or 30 or so years ago. We live in a world in which things are much more visible, monitored by the global community. That's why when I mentioned the Seattle confrontation at the end of the last lecture, last term, I tried to stress that there you're dealing with the two aspects of globalization, not just those who are for globalization and those who are against it. Every time you go into whatever it is, C145, or you switch on your home computer, you are contributing to globalization processes. And it was through the internet that a lot of groups assembled in Seattle to contest what they called globalization. But all these phenomena are expressions of a world where everything is more visible. Well, a world where everything is more visible, as I'll try and explain in a minute, I think has consequences both for the nature of democracy and the legitimacy of existing democratic systems. That world of globalization is creating something like what you could call an open information order. That open information order being carried by new technologies, but also being produced by all of us as we engage in these globalization processes with our computers or whatever means we use, the radio, TV, or whatever, to become involved with them. In an open information order, all sorts of processes of concealment of power, which used to operate, become much more difficult to persist with. Now, there's going to be a battle in this century, as we can see, shaping up around this emerging information order. It comes up against corporate power. It comes up against, for example, the power of Microsoft worldwide, which itself is being contested in the American courts at the moment. As you probably know, an antitrust suit has been brought against Microsoft by the American government, and the initial findings were hostile to Microsoft, implying that the company might have to break itself up. On the other hand, the internet and other forms of communication, they're going to be a site of struggle for corporate ownership, marketing, commercialism, the reimposition of power, if you like, on the exchange of information. We don't know which way it'll turn out, but my feeling is that the information has escaped. There's no way of going back to a world of information control, so that even if the big corporations do have a substantial impact on the internet or other communication systems, even if governments do or try to, they won't be able to push the world back into a situation of information monopoly. I don't see that there is really any way back to such a situation. An open information order is plainly a democratizing thing, I think. The more information they get, the more you're able to engage in it. Of course, there are asymmetries of wealth and power in that as well, as I'll come on to talking about next time. Third, we have the emergence of more reflexive, populations across the world, conforming to the model of reflexivity, which I discussed in an earlier lecture. The reflexive world is simply one where you regularly engage with information, and you do so in a way in which you make active use of that information in order to order your life, to contest others who have a different definition of it, and to explore the possibilities open to you. On the whole, I think the more educated you are, the more affluent you are, the more your reflexive engagement with the world. There is a definite class division here. Among the poor, among those who have less access to the information revolution, I think for them, for many people, life is still more like fate, as I described it before, than it is probably for most people in this room. For us, our lives depart more and more from fate because we actively engage with so many things going on around us. You can trace this out, for example, in medical diagnosis, when lots of middle-class people, if they do fall ill, now immediately open their computer, clue into the internet, get into a good site, see what recent research has been about the illness they're suffering from. And when they go to see the doctor, they routinely, as it were, trot out all this information, and they try to engage in a kind of dialogue with the doctor rather than sitting there waiting for the doctor to tell them what's wrong with them. So again, I think a clear class division in this. On the whole, however, population of the world is becoming more reflexive. In a more reflective world of open information engagement, for reasons I'll mention in a minute, traditional forms of political legitimation become under strain. And this is again inherently a democratizing kind of consequence for the global society. Fourth, across the world, you have the fundamental phenomenon that I've mentioned many times, but is terribly important to any structural analysis of world society, the growing equality of women and men. Very, very important in democracy. You can barely sort of over-exaggerate its importance to democracy. Because as I stressed before, democracy always excluded women. This was true even of the most advanced democracies in the Western world. I mean, many people now, for example, think that Switzerland is perhaps the most democratic country in the West because it has very decentralized local referenda system. You know, in Switzerland, the cantons have a lot of power. But women didn't get the vote in Switzerland, I think, until in the 1950s, as late as 1950s, something like 1947 or close to the 1950s before women got the vote in Switzerland. So the involvement of women in democratic process is a fundamental transition for world society. And the increasing equality of the sexes is therefore having a major impact, I think, upon democratization across the world. And you should remember a thing that I've stressed before and will stress again in the next lecture, the transformation of women in poorer communities is the most important factor allowing leverage away from poverty too in those communities. And this has also been demonstrably shown by recent research. So the involvement of women with democracy is a fundamental thing, but the increasing equality of men and women means that cultures which try to hold back the tide of democracy find it difficult to do so. And when they try and do so, like Taliban in Afghanistan, for example, they tend to become highly aggressive, quasi-fundamentalist in their assertion of this. It's almost impossible, certainly one hopes it's impossible, to hold back this rising tide of democracy associated with this important thing. And I strongly stress again, increasing equality of the sex is itself a major factor of globalization in the contemporary world. Reinforced, of course, by the entry of women into the labor force in so many different countries in much larger numbers than before. Now, I'd like to suggest to you, and propose to you anyway, that these factors underlie the expansion of democracy across the world, and at the same time, they are responsible for the disaffection felt with democracy in the more advanced democratic states. They underlie democracy because in an emerging globalized information order where men and women are more equal, these are very, very powerful structural levers affecting people in most countries. They, of course, therefore, filter through to political processes. They, of course, influence the demands of citizenry. But they also change the nature of power. In an earlier lecture, I defined our age as a move from hard power to soft power. Hard power is military power. Hard power is authoritarian, top-down, bureaucratic power. In a more open, globalized, electronic world, soft power, decentralized power, getting the involvement of those over whom authority is wielded, this becomes much more central. Has a commercial edge, of course, with the manipulation of images and so forth. But the most effective forms of power in the world are no longer the ones that used to be most effective. You could chart this out for sociologists here by saying it's the rise and fall of Max Weber, really. Max Weber used to argue that the most effective forms of power form a triangle, strongly centralized power in bureaucratic systems. To that, many people might add military power. Well, these things have become largely dysfunctional in this kind of world into which we're moving. So there is a kind of structural compatibility between these changes, I think anyway, and the generalized expansion of political democracy. Of course, the one doesn't simply explain the other. Of course, you have all sorts of contingent events in different parts of the world. You have struggles for democracy. People have to actively fight for democracy, just like they do women's rights, for example. You can't treat these structural forces just working themselves out, but they give you the leverage for struggle. They give you the leverage for change, and they give you the leverage for different forms of political power from the past. Why do they cause disaffection within the established democracies? Well, I think two main reasons, I would suggest. One is that in such democracies, in such countries, which do tend to have highly educated populations, people come to see that many of the claims that politicians make those politicians can't justify. When you live in a global era, when there are so many things that affect us in the world, which come from within the realm of the nation, it's not surprising that people become skeptical of the claims of national political leaders to exert the power that they do. Not surprising that people see political leaders as posturing rather than being able to make substantial, profound, effective changes in the countries in question. Second, when you move towards a more globalizing open information order, old forms of legitimacy, political legitimacy, become ineffective, I think. And most surveys show this is particularly strongly felt by the younger generation. Patronage, domination of politics by male politicians, backstage deals, fixes, forms of institutional ways of doing politics now become seen as corrupt in the contemporary world. It's not accidental, I think, that you have corruption cases in politics all across the world in the last 10 to 15 or so years. Not, I think, because there's more corruption than there used to be, although this may be true, of course, in some circumstances, but mainly because ways of doing things which used to be legitimate or accepted as legitimate are no longer accepted as such. You can see what's happening in Germany to Helmut Kohl as an example of that. What Kohl did was wrong, but it was probably the way in which things were conventionally done, one assumes, by political leaders in that kind of setup. Ways of doing things that used to be simply the way things are done are no longer, regardless, legitimate. I can give you a homely little example from this, from the case of the LSE, because previous directors of the LSE, before me anyway, were selected by a kind of band of men in smoke-filled rooms in London clubs. It was done rather like, you know, way in which people used to choose the leader of the Tory party. You can't do that anymore. I'm happy to say that in my case there was an open selection procedure. There were many, many applications. The whole thing was carefully monitored. You simply can't run organisations as you used to do and hope for those organisations to be legitimate. It's very important, I think, the second thing, because it shows you that people might be reacting too far against the impotence of politicians. I think the political power still counts for a lot. I still think that nations still count for a lot. I think that national political power and democratic party processes are still very important. But in order to recapture that power, and in order to recapture trust in politics, we surely need to make structural changes in Western democracy, as well as simply encouraging other countries to copy it. We must address the democratic deficit in Western democracies at the same time as we hopefully help promote the expansion of democracy across the world. Now, various consequences, I think, stem from this and from some of the other material I've been discussing in other lectures. First of all, I think we've got a good idea of what a democratic polity plus... Oh, sorry. Well, I'm not writing anything very interesting. Democratic polity plus a good society is like in the contemporary world. It involves a balance between three sets of factors, and when these get out of alignment, a society is in trouble. First of all, you must have sufficient good government in a society for that government to be able to steer the development of the society. A society which is inefficient, ineffective government is not going to be a good democratic system. On the other hand, we also know from the experience of Soviet-style society and other types of authoritarian regime that you mustn't allow government to become too strong, because if you do so, it can dominate both the population and other parts of the makeup of the socioeconomic order. Second, you need a well-functioning market. You need a well-functioning market economy. That market economy must be strong enough to do the job that markets should do, which is provide for signals between producers and consumers and generate reasonable economic prosperity. But you mustn't allow the market too much play either. Because if you allow the market too much power, you get commercialism of areas of life which shouldn't be commercialized, you get erratic development, you get crisis tendencies, and so on. Third, crucially, you need civil society. Without civil society, you can't balance the other two. Without civil society, an effective civil society, you can't have active democratic culture, as we see from the case of Russia. On the other hand, you can't have an effective market economy either. Now, you need enough of good civil society to balance off the other institutions. But again, you don't need too much. If civil society becomes too powerful, then you have a Northern Ireland type situation where groups are liable to be in conflict with one another, uncontrolled or not controlled sufficiently by the regulative mechanisms of the market and government. A good society then is one which achieves a balance between these different institutions, and that is the condition of an effective democracy at the same time in the contemporary world. Question is, can you build such a society in countries which are undergoing rapid transition? If you take the example of Russia, it's a good example to take for this, I think. Many people say that democracy is, as it were, a fragile flower. That to have a democracy, you need long-term development of civic culture and civil society. That you can't build a democracy overnight. That therefore it's simply hopeless to assume that Russia could become an effective democratic state. I think if you look at the structural changes affecting world society that I've been talking about, it might be more correct to treat democracy as something like a sturdy plant rather than a fragile flower. A fragile flower won't grow on barren ground, but a sturdy plant will. And I would be myself much more optimistic about the chances of democratization in Russia, to go back to the theme of optimism, than many critics would be. And I think it is conceivable, in this kind of world in which we're entering, it is conceivable and it is possible to make democratic transitions quite rapidly, even against an unpropitious background. We know that, for example, a country like the ones I mentioned, Mali or Mozambique in Africa, have made a very good stab at that from very unpropitious beginnings, worse than Russia, I think. So one shouldn't give up despair of constructing a kind of civic background to a market economy and a democratic system, but it plainly will depend upon the effective deployment of political power and other structural changes in that society. Second, in Western countries, I've been arguing for quite a long time, in different contexts, not just in these lectures, that we need a process of the democratizing of democracy. The democratizing of democracy, for me, means bringing Western democratic systems into line with the structural changes I've been talking about. It means, if you like, a second wave of democratization. What it means in different countries varies, but in all countries it means contesting corruption. It means recognizing that the definition of corruption has changed, that many things that were accepted before as democratic processes should no longer be accepted. It means contesting the things I mentioned before, backstage deals, fixes, all the sorts of things that go along in the background of politics. It means asserting, crucially, the right of women not just to vote in democratic processes, but to be represented in an egalitarian fashion in the core systems of political power. In many countries, it means the devolution of political power, including this one. You can see how difficult, from the UK example, you can see how difficult devolution can be, but devolution of power, return of democratic processes to the local community, is surely a key reaction to globalization. It means constitutional reform in many countries. It means an openness and transparency, not just in the democratic system, but openness and transparency in banking institutions and other institutions which overlap with political power. In the second wave of democratization, there is an awful lot to be done. But I think second wave democratization can hope to recapture political legitimacy. Because the findings about trust in politics that I mentioned among the generation of most people sitting here, the younger generation, shows that although the younger generation is disaffected with orthodox politics, it is by no means disaffected with politics as a whole. The current younger generation displays more interest in politics than previous younger generations in Western European countries, but they simply believe the existing mechanisms of politics are not up to delivering upon these values. Well, anyone's interested in political reform, I think, must try to turn these systems into becoming more capable of delivering that. Now, you can't only do this on a national level, so it seems to me anyways. Therefore, you must put on the agenda the increasing possibility and indeed necessity of transnational democratization. You need devolution of power down below the level of the nation state, but you also need devolution of power upwards. We have to seriously explore possibilities of democracy in the global arena. Why? Well, because the perceptions of people are to some extent accurate. Many things which affect us in the world, like ecological problems, responding to global economic crises, responding to mass patterns of migration, you can't deal with those things on the level of the nation. You can't deal with the question of whether or not you should permit the cloning of human beings simply on a national level. We therefore must develop international law, and we must explore processes of transnational democratization. What could they be? Well, I think they could be two forms. First of all, you have a form of transnational democratization in the shape of the European Union, which is already in existence. The European Union is not simply an association of nations, like the United Nations is. It's a new system of government in which countries have voluntarily given up sovereignty in order to participate. Now, the European Union famously has a democratic deficit. It's not very democratic, it's quite bureaucratic, it's distant from its populations. How far Mr. Brody can cope with these issues, can produce a further democratisation of the European Union, is likely to be crucial. As I mentioned in a previous lecture again, I would like to see such experiments going on in other parts of the world too. Second, we should seriously explore the possibility of David Held's cosmopolitan democracy. Cosmopolitan democracy would be the globalization of democratic institutions. It would suggest that just as you have a European parliament, you might have an African parliament, South American parliament, Asian parliament, that these parliaments might be able to send representatives to a reconstituted second body of the United Nations. And it is at least conceivable and not utopian to suppose that we could construct such effective mechanisms. The reasons why Held says it's not utopian go back again to globalization. Communications are so much easier than they were. We know that a devolution of power upwards can go along with the devolution of power downwards. That's really what would make the European Union more democratic, not just the reform of parliamentary institutions, but an effective devolution of power downwards. Subsidiarity, as it's called within the European Union, become a reality rather than just an ideology. Well, the same thing could apply on a world level. It doesn't follow, I think David is quite right to say, that a world body would necessarily be remote from its citizenry. Mechanisms of transnational democratization clearly have to be integrated with international law, and they can't be disconnected from the global control of the means of violence and military power. That's why the Pinochet case is a very interesting example. We don't know what its consequences will be. We don't know what it means, General Pinochet going back to Chile. We don't know if it means a kind of cop-out or whatever. But it is a kind of signal process that people are starting to explore the limits of sovereignty. You cannot have an effective movement towards processes of transnational democratization unless at the same time you expand and make count systems of human rights in international law. I feel it's up to us in the next 20 or so years to try to push those things forward. I think they're no longer utopian ambitions to try to produce this. All this operates against the background of massive inequality, and that will be the theme of my lecture next time. So nice to see you all again. Thanks very much.